You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 7th to the 13th of May 2015. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, rankings reporter Ellie Bothwell and reporter Chris Havergal. Many of you will be familiar with the OECD's PISA rankings of school-level education systems. The UK's performance within them is usually headline news. The higher education equivalent, known as AHELO, or the Assessment of Higher Education Learning Outcomes, could be given the go-ahead very soon. Could it be the silver bullet for measuring teaching quality? It's the topic of our lead news story this week. Are European universities being stifled by laws that force them to teach courses in their country's native language? That's certainly the view of one of the speakers at last week's Times Higher Education Young Universities Summit. Ellie will tell us a bit more in just a few moments' time. And the QAA will not release details of a successful appeal lodged by the University of Southampton against critical findings in a review of its performance. But what does the new review of the institution find? Chris will tell us soon, and he'll also let us know some of the most unusual things that university PR departments have been asked to publicise. Some interesting things in there too, so do stick around for that. But first, Simon, AHELO, it's a funny acronym, the Assessment of Higher Education Learning Outcomes, and it could get the green light soon.
Yeah, well, the reason we've covered this week is because the OECD countries have basically got until the end of this month to decide whether they want to take part in this project, which we've looked at before. It's been a few years in the making. Why it's significant is because, as you mentioned in the introduction, you know, PISA, the measure of school kind of achievement across the world, has become a headline news every time it's announced, because it means countries can compare their standards of education in some way. And why this is so important for higher education is because, you know, a big kind of topic that's often comes out in higher education is that, you know, teaching, although research is measured, and we have the research assessment exercise in this country, and it seems quite clear that you can measure research in some ways, teaching is very difficult to measure, because everyone knows that if you could actually show which universities are adding value in what they teach students, then that university can say, well, here's clear evidence that why a student should come to our university. At the moment, a lot of people argue that some universities do very well, or they attract students simply on reputation, really, and on selecting the students that have come out of school with the best grades, and that some of those universities aren't actually adding value to those students while they're at university. So what this project would aim to do would basically try and compare standards of graduates and their skills across different universities across the world. And obviously that could lead to major shake-up in the way that different universities are viewed.
Yeah, I mean, across the world is one of the key phrases there, isn't it, as well? Because I know our piece, it's written by John Morgan, the deputy news editor, who's not here. But one of the things in his piece is the fact that you could see sort of institutions in the Far East, for example, being brought far more into competition with those in the West, possibly even benefiting from this assessment exercise.
Yeah, exactly, because going back to my reputation argument, a lot of people would argue that some universities are attracting students due to their reputation and prestige. If you suddenly have this assessment which can compare universities on the same standard across the world, who knows, you could have some universities in the East that have they've probably got more to gain from this, because they suddenly could say, well, hang on a minute, we can show we're adding all these skills at university, where there's some Western universities that are basically relying on reputation. It shows that they're not doing so well. So that might be, but also the politics of that may be very interesting in terms of which countries want to carry this forward. And a big question for me is that, okay, so say the UK carries this forward. We quote David Willetts in this, the former universities minister, as saying, that the Conservatives are quite interested in this kind of measure of measuring teaching quality. well, if the UK carry it forward, you know, the government are interested in it, but how do they get institutions to buy into it? How do we get, how do we make sure the graduates of all these universities take part in the test? Because, you know, unlike schools, the government can't tell these universities what to do. They're autonomous institutions. So, you know, it would seem to me that some universities may not be that keen on letting their graduates take it if that's the kind of outcome. So there's a lot of big question marks.
I mean, also, is there a sense of how the test would actually work? I mean, teaching quality is a pretty subjective thing. The missions of universities and student bodies around the world is pretty different. Could you actually have sort of one test or one scale of assessment that you'd actually be able to put everyone onto?
Well, I think it would need to be controlled in some way. So, for instance, if you have a standard test for all graduates and it shows that they have a certain level of aptitude or skill in certain areas, then, you know, the next question is, how do you compare a graduate of, say, one university with another? And couldn't you just say, well, of course, the graduates of, say, Oxford are going to do much better on this because they were, you know, pretty intelligent to start with. So, you know, how are you going to control for that? Will there be a way of controlling the results so that you're comparing their results against the entry level they went in at, basically? In you know, do you find a way of standardising A-level results and comparing them with, you know, school results in America and saying, okay, so the students came in at that level, but these universities pushed them to this level? I mean, it's all the actual technical side of that. You know, there's big questions to be answered, definitely.
Because then whether you're having sort of disciplinary knowledge or whether you're looking at very sort of transferable things like sort of critical thinking or something like that, and how do you define what you should get out of a university education is a long way to go by the sounds of it.
Yeah, exactly. And what people expect to get out of a university education and what people do get out of it is obviously very different if you take an arts or humanities subject from taking a STEM subject, for instance. I mean, you do not, you know, you're training, some people would argue that you're training your mind in a different way, really.
Well, the discussion of that move is on page 6 and 7 in this week's magazine. It's also on timeshighereducation.co.uk, of course. Other institutions that I guess might benefit from the AHELO project are young universities, those under the age of 50, again, perhaps without the established reputation of some of the older institutions. Ellie, last week you were out in Dublin at the Times Higher Education Young Universities Summit. Your news story in this week's magazine focuses on a speech by the impressively titled Rector Magnificus of Maastricht University, Luc Serta. He was talking about language.
Yes, he was talking about the need for universities that are in Europe but outside the UK to teach courses in English, and his concerns that there are linguistic human rights laws that mean countries can only offer courses in English if they're also available in the country's native language. And he's actually already negotiated with the Dutch government so that he can teach also courses at Maastricht can be taught in English. But he's concerned that the other universities in Europe are stifled by these laws that prevent them from internationalising, from sort of being the agile, flexible type of institutions that young universities need to be.
Of course, English very much the language of academia in many ways, although I suppose that's a debate that's still to be had. What else came out of that summit? I know you were over in Dublin. We co-hosted it with Dublin City University this year. A few stories have come out already. What was the sort of themes? What was the feel of the conference this year?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, you launched the 100 under 50 rankings, and then alongside that, there were some excellent speakers. We had sort of speakers from the top young universities, so Bertil Anderson from Nanyang, which was fifth, and Patrick Ibershire, who's president of EPFL, which is first, spoke. Lord David Putnam was also there. One of the main trends that came about was that these are universities that are still evolving. And a few of the speakers sort of spoke about the fact that because they're kind of agile, it means that students and staff can help shape their construction, which has actually made them potentially more attractive. One of the examples was David Lloyd at South Australia speaking about the Uni Jam, which is probably the most prominent example, the 48-hour kind of online brainstorm where students, staff, kind of anyone who wants to get involved really could kind of shape how the university could be in the future. And then of course there was a network of young research universities that was launched at the summit. It's formed of 18 universities, all under 50 years old, and they decided to set up this network so that they could help increase their influence in education policy. And they actually said that their sort of inclusion in the rankings gives them leverage to help decide that.
Indeed, very good. Well, you can read up on that group on timeshighereducation.co.uk. There's a news piece on there. We also covered Unijam as well. Search for that and you'll get all the story on that. Back in the UK, though, Chris, the Quality Assurance Agency review of Southampton is making the news this week, and it's not for the first time.
Yeah, this is coming out of the latest institutional review of the University of Southampton. This is a review that finds that Southampton meets or exceeds expectations in all areas of higher education provision. What's perhaps more intriguing about the review is what it doesn't say. What it doesn't do is make any mention of an earlier review, which was conducted in 2012, and which did have some critical findings about Southampton. What was interesting, that in the first case of its kind, Southampton successfully appealed against that report, and it was set aside, hence the new review which has just been published. At the time of the appeal, both Southampton and the QIA stated that the findings of the appeal panel would be made public when the new review report is published. But in 2014, the QIA changed its rules to keep details of appeals secret. The appeal preceded that decision. However, since the second review came after that decision, the QIA has decided that the new rules should apply to the Southampton process in its entirety, and that's why we haven't heard anything about the appeal. Perhaps why this is significant is that the future of quality assurance and the QIA is being debated at the moment, and there are some people who say that QIA, isn't fit for purpose to govern the sector. And one of the questions which is raised about the QIA is about transparency. And critics of the QIA would say that this episode, shows that, the QIA is not doing an effective job of monitoring the sector effectively and transparently.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a tricky subject, isn't it? I mean, you, to put it in blunt terms, you must have approached the QIA and asked for this information, and what were you told?
The QIA simply say that they changed their rules in December 2013, and the decision was made then that the new rules would apply to any reviews completed after January 2014. A spokesman told me that as the Southampton review completed in its entirety after January 2014, the new process therefore applies.
Well, there you go. On a slightly lighter note, another of your stories this week, Chris. A survey of universities and their PR departments in particular, asking what's the most unusual thing you've ever been asked to publicise by an academic? What were the most unusual stories?
Well, there were certainly some surprising findings, which suggest that not all academics have quite got the hang of what their communications departments are paid to do. One academic asked their communications department to publicise their attendance at a conference. Another highlighted an internal workshop. There was also a trip abroad to visit another university, and indeed their own business. However, perhaps the most surprising was the academic who asked their presumably rather surprised communications director to publicise news of their birthday in the national press.
Perhaps they didn't get enough cards last year. Well, that's all from this week's THE issue review. Elsewhere in the news section, it's election day when we come out, which makes it difficult for news planning, but we do have a few stories in there. Speculation about what a hung parliament might mean. We've got the UCL president and provost Michael Arthur saying that no party has demonstrated an effective long-term HE policy. And this week's cover feature has some academics giving their views on what might be done to improve the state of British politics. We've got Carl Smets, lecturer in politics at Royal Holloway, Paul Webb, professor of politics at Sussex, all sorts of people in there, loads of them. So do take a look on timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll also find us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn and Google+, all the usual places. But until until next week, that's all for the THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.